For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
The Morning Show. The Home Team. No, it's both. It's the crossover with Sam Franco and Chris Brame.
Crossover, step back! Ah! At the buzzer!
Right here on 960theref.com.
What's up, everybody? Sam Franco, Chris Brame back with another exciting edition of the crossover podcast right here on 960theref.com. Plenty to get to today. We'll talk Final Four. We'll talk about the opening day of Major League Baseball, what to expect from the season, what to expect from the Braves. And we'll also talk some NFL rule changes, including one that might have just been made official, but also might have been employed during the Super Bowl. So the way that a play was called all season long might have been called differently in the Super Bowl, which has some people irked.
Yeah, but like I already assumed that anyway.
This is Corey whether Clement or not catch. It's a catch or not.
Yeah, it was the Corey Clement right. Catch in the back of the end zone where the ball was shifting from one of his arms to the other. There's 100% if that had been the regular season, that would have been called an incomplete pass, but there's no way that the NFL was going to let that go in the Super Bowl with those millions more people that are watching that are sitting there going, what do they mean that's not a catch? It would have been stupid.
Right, so we'll dive more into that a little bit later on in the podcast, but first and foremost, the Sister Jean Four is heading to San Antonio. That's also more commonly known as the Final Four. But this year, Sister Jean, obviously a huge story involved. You'll have Loyola Chicago taking on Michigan. The winner of that game will face the winner of the Kansas and Villanova game. So two real blue bloods on one side and two teams. And Michigan has a decent basketball history. You know, the Fab Five, all that stuff. Chris Webber calling the timeout he didn't have. So they had those teams. And then also John Beilein's done a really good job at Michigan. They were in the Final Four, in 2013, obviously, when the championship was won by Louisville, although technically now I guess there's no champion for that season. But this Michigan team has done a very good job of upping their profile basketball-wise. So I think this is a very entertaining Final Four.
Yes, somebody asked me earlier in the week, like, you know, who I thought the best coach was remaining in the Final Four, and my answer was Jay Wright, but I think Beilein could be the answer to that.
Very
the guy's
coach.
Done. He won at West Virginia. He's done a great job at Michigan. Like you said, he's had him in the national championship game just 5 years ago now, and now they're back again in the Final Four after sweeping the through the Big Ten tournament too. So, you know, Beilein definitely is a contender there. What I love so far is that we've had Twitter beef between 98-year-old Sister Jean and the 100-year-old grandmother of Jalen Rose, who are going at it back and forth. But, you know, Jalen Rose's grandma, she's kind of jumping in here late. I mean,
I think
America's hearts have already been grabbed by Sister Jean. So,
well, here's the thing about anybody that's hating on Sister Jean right now. It just feels like you're coming out of you're crawling out of your hole and you're jumping on her coattails. It's like, oh man, this 98-year-old grandma has, not grandma because she can't have kids.
Right.
She's 98-year-old nun has swept the nation. So I'm going to go out on social media and talk trash about her and see if I can ride her coattails. It's like, man, get off of Sister Jean.
Well, yeah, I guess now, like, to attack Sister Jean, you feel like you're being the contrarian because everybody
course.
Is.
You're just trying to get famous or make a name for yourself off the name that she's already established.
Yeah. Well, it's like great because, you know, I mean, traditionally, like, Loyola would be the underdog that we'd all be falling in love with. But, I guess at this point, yeah. I mean, I would love to see Loyola win the national championship. But,
hey, they already got one. Every team in this field has won a national championship.
I know.
It was Michigan in 89, I believe.
Yep.
And then you also have Kansas and Villanova. Everybody knows about them. Villanova has two. This would be their third. And Kansas, for as many times as Bill Self has let them down, he actually does have a national championship there, as did Larry Brown with Danny Manning and the Miracles And I'm trying to think in their past.
They've got one from the 50s, right. 60s.
So all of these schools really have a tradition of basketball because they've all won national championships before.
Yeah, I mean, Loyola won one in 1963. Sister Jean was 43
was
years
there.
Old. And so she remembers it for sure. But, they're the Cinderella. They're the 11th seed. But it is interesting that, okay, you even with this team that right now is – viewed as the Cinderella. I mean, yeah, they do have a Final Four and a national championship in their history. So with all the wildness of the tournament that, I mean, nothing is bigger than the fact that we saw for the first time ever a 16 defeat a one seed. You still do end up with a Final Four. Two of the number ones are in it. You got a three down there in the bottom. And then, all right, Loyola's an 11 seed. I mean, I won't say that they're not a Cinderella story.
Well, that's why when you're filling out a bracket, you can't make your name off of picking upsets constantly, because look at the Final Four, 1-1, 3-11. I mean, the 11 is an anomaly there, but still, I mean, chalk normally wins. I'll just look at the women's Final Four, all four number one seeds made it to the Final Four.
Yeah, well, in Connecticut, this is what, their 11th straight year, so if you fill out a women's bracket, I'd go ahead and just put them in the Final Four.
By the way, what Connecticut did to South Carolina the other day, a lot of people, you know, South Carolina was kind of, last year they were the national champion, but a lot of people were like, yeah, but they avoided UConn. And the only reason that UConn lost to Mississippi State last year is because of Tierra McCowan. I mean, that girl is unbelievable. She's like 6'7" and just that force. And they'll have to play, I would assume, in the Final Four at some point. So we'll get that matchup again. But it's just interesting to look at what UConn did, because they're like, trying to prove themselves, I guess, against South Carolina.
No doubt. I mean, UConn.
There was a little bit of a chip on their shoulder going into that game, and they blew out South Carolina.
Yeah. I mean, their position in that game was, okay, you're the reigning national champs, but we were really the best team in the country last year.
Well, they'd already gone into Columbia this year and beaten them.
Yeah,
by like,
well, I think they beat them
something.
Last year, too. They've been playing each other the last couple of years. But, yeah, South Carolina dodged a bullet thanks to Mississippi State.
But they could not dodge that bullet this time.
No, they did not, and they got hammered. Not quite as bad is whoever it was they played in the Connecticut played in the first round.
Oh, well, the 16th seed St. Francis, where they scored 140 points.
And had 55 in the first quarter.
They had 101 points with, I think, 17 minutes left in the game.
Yeah.
That's just,
I know,
unbelievable.
They even outscored them in the fourth quarter, like 24-2 or something like that.
Just
so
absurd. But, yeah, getting back to the men's side of things, looking at that Loyola-Michigan matchup, here's what I have to say about Loyola. I think that because Sister Jean has really swept the nation and she's the big story with Loyola, this team has been sort of, you know, sheltered from criticism or sheltered from pressure, because it seems like more and more the interviews want to go to Sister Jean and not really the coach, not really the people on the team. So they're allowed to operate under the radar even a little bit more and not maybe have that spotlight and that pressure on them because they have this nun who has really become the story.
Yeah, no, that's a good point. I mean, they could show up this weekend and not sort of like really get caught up in the magnitude of, oh my gosh, we're in the Final Four, and they've got, you know, these just reams of reporters that are surrounding them, because, yeah, the attention is going to go to Sister Jean probably instead of them. And that could, you know, maybe help them not get stage fright there or blinded by the big lights. But, yeah, this is a team that beat Florida in Gainesville during the regular season. I'm not going to say that they're not a fluke. They were an 11 seed, and they're from the Missouri Valley Conference, and they're in the Final Four now. But, they probably are better than you probably
would give them credit
for. I mean, that being said, my leans are still, I'd take Michigan and Villanova to play Monday night for the title, which would be a heck of a game.
I'll say this, I'm gonna give Loyola a chance to beat Michigan. I don't know if they will. I don't really give them a chance to beat either Villanova or Kansas, just because it feels like that they've taken advantage of somewhat of an easier route to the Final Four than maybe they would have been used to, or maybe they thought they would have had to do. So I think they could beat Michigan, because here's the thing about Michigan. Throughout the course of the season, they were a defense-led team that all of a sudden in the Big Ten and now NCAA tournament has exploded offensively. I mean, they are hitting shots from the outside. They are, you know, they blitzed a few teams here.
That Sweet 16 game, where the
A&M
against A&M, where they scored the 99 points and hit like 14 or 15 threes. Was
right.
Not even remotely sustainable.
No, but that's the thing. They got hot. They're in the tournament right now. Teams do that sometimes. You know, you get on that roll and you become a hot shooting team. So And they have a guy named Wagner on their team, so that makes it even better.
UConn did it that one year. I mean, there are other examples,
too.
They
won six straight games in the Big East tournament because they had to play, like, the opening round game there.
They won six games on a Tuesday back then.
And I think they won six games in a row, or they did win six games in a row, so they were on a massive hot streak. And that's what's happened to Michigan here. They've gone on a big-time hot streak, and that's helped them out. So that's going to be – I think that's going to be a very interesting game. The other side of things, Kansas and Villanova – I think one thing that this tournament has proven to us is that Villanova is the best team in the country just based on what they've done and quite frankly, the eyeball test. And I don't really think it's that close. I think Kansas got very lucky to win that game against Duke because, you know, if Duke had probably had a little bit of a better game plan down the stretch and not decided to go ISO Grayson Allen. And look, Grayson Allen made four clutch free throws at the end of that game, and he made like a shot kind of towards the end to tie it. And then he goes, it still blows my mind that the play for Duke's season with very little time left on the clock was Grayson Allen with the ball at the top of the key and him trying to drive to the hole and make something happen. I'm like, look, he's been important to them and I get it, but ISO Grayson Allen, not the move I would have made there against Kansas.
No, I got to tell you, I thought Coach K got out, he got out coached in that game by Bill Self. I feel like Kansas scored coming out of every single timeout too. They had some play drawn up. They needed points at that time.
They had that Newman guy just go off, which was crazy. Yeah. And it set off a chain reaction on Twitter of everybody tweeting Seinfeld Newman gist.
Yeah, I noticed that, which is good for Newman and Wayne Knight.
Although a lot of people were tweeting Wayne Knight. See, I tweeted, because I had to go for Duke to win the pool here. By the way, your normal co-host, Jeff Dantzler, in a very good position. If Villanova beats Kansas, he wins the bracket pool.
Yeah, I love that our pool is so bad that the national championship game will be irrelevant.
It's irrelevant. No, yeah. We only have one game left that will determine the winner of our bracket pool. That's how bad – well, that's how bad everybody's has been. I mean, nobody got Loyola or Michigan in the Final Four. So it's certainly been interesting. But – I just think that the way that that whole Newman thing went down, everybody was tweeting Newman GIFs. I tweeted a GIF of Seinfeld going, Newman, because I needed Duke to win, and they obviously didn't win. And again, going ISO Grayson Allen was a weird choice of play by Coach K.
No, to me, it's like Gary Trent should be their go-to guy when they need a shot. And then he hit that one, it was – I mean, he kind of miracled out. I mean, no one for Duke was shooting well, but remember, it was right at the end of a shot clock. He threw one up from pretty deep, and it went down.
Yeah, right.
And I don't know that he had another shot after that.
No, and then you had
stopped going to him.
Well, and then you had the whole thing with Wendell Carter fouling out on what was clearly a charge. Like, I don't know how much more that could have been.
But, you know, I mean, for the first time ever,
when it gets Duke.
Duke didn't get a call, so it's hard to unless you were like you and you needed Duke to win, you're like griping about that. But I'm like, that was a bad call. But I mean, I can't feel bad for Duke getting a bad call.
No, of course not. So, you know, I think I'm going to go ahead and take Loyola against Michigan for no other reason than the fact that they might be flying a little under the radar.
Even you're rooting for.
And it's plus it is who I'm rooting for. I think Villanova wins on the other side. I think Villanova wins a national championship, an all-Catholic final.
Yeah, I mean, Villanova, and I get, you know, Kansas kind of has that reputation, too. That's why it's kind of an interesting Final Four matchup.
The choking reputation.
Well, where it's either like they're, you know, like, because Villanova, they won the title, then came back last year and lost in the second round. Didn't NC State beat them in round two last year? And then here they are in the Final Four. So it's kind of either like they're going to get upset early or they make it all the way to the end. And now here both of them are. They've made it all the way to the end. But
I mean, Bill Self has a lot of pressure on him. I mean, you know, these Kansas fans are starting to get antsy. They haven't won the national title since the Derrick Rose game back when they beat Memphis. So I think the Kansas fan base starting to get a little antsy.
Yeah, and Nova did just win it a couple of years ago. I think Jay Wright's a better coach if you're looking at a coaching matchup. The only thing that does, I mean, make me nervous about Nova, but listen, they've been the best team in the country for most of the year, and here they are as a one seed that's made it to the Final Four. They are so reliant on the three-pointer that if they just have one of those games that's not dropping, then they could get beaten. But you know, I think back to the Final Four game against Oklahoma 2 years ago where they won by, what, 45? They were the shooting that they had in that Final Four, which was, by the way, in Houston. Mm-hmm. So now they're just, I was going to say, just down the road in San Antonio, in Texas, it's like four states away. But, so they're back in Texas for another Final Four. But, I mean, they were just insanely hot in the Final Four a couple years ago, and that's just it. And then that's why when they beat Alabama, what they took 41 three-pointers in that game,
yeah,
and crushed the Tide in the second round. But you know, if there just turns out to be a game they're not going, then they could definitely get beaten. But you know, they've made it this far; it hadn't been a problem.
Yeah, so we'll see what ends up happening with the Final Four. It's certainly an intriguing one. There's no question about that. With the two number one seeds, the Kansas, can they, you know, finally do it again? Villanova, with what Jay Wright's built there, and really become one of the most dominant programs in college basketball over the last, you know, 5-6 years. And then you look at the other side, just a matchup that nobody expected. So, Final Four coming your way. I think Villanova wins the whole thing. And since we won't be doing a show before Monday with the national championship, that'll put a wrap, a nice little bow in the college basketball season. And then we all get to sit around and wait for the FBI to drop this bomb whenever they decide to.
Now, I'm waiting for the Maui Classic next year.
2019 is when Georgia will be in that.
Oh, it's not the next season?
It is not next season.
Oh.
Auburn will be the SEC's representative in the Maui Invitational in 2018.
Oh, okay.
Yes. But still a big, huge deal for Georgia to be in the marquee early in the season basketball tournament. There's no doubt the Maui Invitational is the most hyped, the most promoted, and the best field every year for these kind of early in the season tournaments that they do.
Okay.
So I'm very excited for that. And shout out to Coach Crean for getting the Dogs in there. All right, we'll switch gears now. Major League Baseball opening day as we record this. I believe that a game will start here very shortly as we record on Thursday. And it's just interesting to me. You look at what the Braves have for this season, and they catch an unfortunate bounce with the Phillies opening things up, because that means they're going to see Aaron Nola and Jake Arrieta. You know, I mean, they get the two best guys for the Phillies right out of the gate, and a team that, other than those two guys, you don't really know what they're going to bring to the table. But you've got to hope with the Braves that, you know, they can keep tread water here without Ronald Acuña for the first 14 days. Then they get Acuña. Hopefully the power numbers go up. And with the pitching, I just think it's some of these guys are just holdover guys until some of the younger arms in the farm system are ready to go.
Yeah, the pitching is the biggest issue with the team this year. I think offensively, Atlanta's got some spots in that lineup that could be really good.
They could definitely impress. Absolutely.
When Acuña eventually comes up, Albies. The catching platoon last year was very good with Suzuki and Flowers also.
And when Johan Camargo, who will start the season on the DL when he comes back, I mean, that's another guy who I think has shown flashes of being a pretty good player.
I mean, the Braves are going to be below average in right field with Markakis. They're going to probably be below average at shortstop with Swanson. Mm-hmm. The question is going to be how long are they going to let that continue on? And then I don't really have huge expectations for third base, but the starting pitching, it's when the rotation is Tehran, Fultonevich, you're going to have McCarthy there at three, and then I guess Newcomb's going to be the four with, to start the year, Sanchez will be the fifth starter. I would imagine that Guajardo, once he comes back off the DL, will slide into that rotation somehow. But like for a 162-game marathon in a season, that Braves starting rotation leaves a lot to be desired right now.
I mean, do we see a Kyle Wright at some point this season? I know you don't want to rush pitchers, but, I mean, that's a guy that the Braves fans are wondering about, very highly drafted player, a pitcher out of Vanderbilt, so... No, we'll see what ends up happening with him as well.
Yeah, I mean, but when you start talking about, are we going to see these young arms, it's just basically because you realize, well, the season's lost somewhere in the middle of it, and you're just ready to see some of these new faces and get their feet wet in the big leagues. But, look, the Nationals have, you have Strasburg, Scherzer, you got Gio Gonzalez still. You know, Syndergaard's returning for the Mets. He only threw like 30 innings last year.
So they've got Harvey, Syndergaard, and DeGrom.
The Phillies, like you said, have Nola as an ace, and they're going to have Arrieta too now that they've added in free agency. So the Braves pitching rotation is it's four out of five teams. The Marlins are definitely dead last in the division.
And dead last in baseball.
Yeah, I mean, to me, the Braves are probably going to be just battling the Phillies for a chance to finish in third place in the East.
Yeah, we kind of forecasted the season on the morning show earlier, and I said that I think the World Series is going to come down to it's always hard to repeat, so I think Houston will have a very good ball club, but I'm not going to pick them. I hate to do this because I don't like the way that Stanton went to New York. It's still fishy in terms of Jeter giving him the New York for a haul that a lot of people thought was very suspect. But I really like Stanton going to New York and providing protection for Aaron Judge, because Aaron Judge is going to – a lot of people are like, man, he had such a great rookie season, but it's going to be harder for him in a sophomore season. Pitchers are going to probably have figured him out, blah, blah, blah. But with Stanton batting behind him, that's going to be a lot better for him in terms of the quality of pitches that he sees. So I think that Stanton, Judge, 1-2 punch, throwing Gary Sanchez as well. I think the Yankees are going to win the American League, face the Dodgers in the World Series. And I think this is finally the year that the Dodgers get over that hump, because they're starting pitching, it feels like, is better than anyone else.
Well, I mean, the Yankees starting pitching is good, but I was looking over the Astros the other day.
They're nasty.
You go Verlander, Keuchel, they've got McCullers, they added Garrett Cole in the offseason.
That's true.
And they got Charlie Morton as a fifth, so...
Do you remember when Charlie Morton was on the Braves?
Yeah, I do. Now he's got a World Series ring now, as do Brian McCann and I guess Evan Gaddis.
I mean, Morton was just a run-of-the-mill, like, middle-of-the-rotation, kind of nothing-special kind of guy, and then he ends up being on the mound when they win the World Series.
Yeah, well, I guess the Braves traded him to Pittsburgh for someone.
That's right.
I don't remember who.
Oh, it was Sean Rodriguez, wasn't it?
No, I think it was him. It was before that.
Oh, okay.
But anyway, because he was okay with the Pirates, and then he's gone to Houston, and he fits in well as like a 4 or 5 starter at the back end of the rotation. But look, I mean, the Astros have an awesome lineup too. I mean, they might not have these two King Kongs there in the center, Judge and Stanton.
That home run Stanton hit the exhibition game at SunTrust Park last Monday was unreal.
Yeah.
He mashed.
Oh yeah. But, you know, it's funny with Stan. I was looking at him. You know, he hit like 200 in the spring. He's one of those guys. He's like Dave Kingman. He doesn't hit for a high average, but, you know, he obviously can mash. I think those guys are projected to hit, you know, over 90 home runs together there. But I know, like you said, we haven't had a team repeat in Major League Baseball since the Yankees did in 98, 99, and 2000. But that Astros pitching rotation in a 7-game series, it's just they got three aces in their rotation.
No, they're scary. But in the National League, it really does kind of feel like, I mean, I'm not going to pick the Nationals because they just choke. They get to a point and they choke.
They haven't won a playoff series yet.
Right. So I'm going to go with the Dodgers. I think their start, in terms of the National League, because like you said, that Houston rotation is scary. But in terms of the National League, I think it's pretty easy to say that the best rotation is with the Dodgers there, just because they have the guy at the top with why am I forgetting his name? the number one pitcher for the
Kershaw.
Dodgers. Thank you, Clayton Kershaw. Man, I'm stumbling.
His ERA this spring was 0.
Yeah, that's pretty solid,
yeah.
Right? I mean,
yeah.
So I think he's going to anchor that rotation. Alex Wood obviously is a very important pitcher for them too. So, you know, I think the Dodgers is finally going to be their year to get over that hump and win. I know they were in the World Series last year, but they hit a buzzsaw in the Houston Astros with that pitching and the hitting. So I think that the Dodgers beat the Yankees in the World Series just because, like you said there, if anybody's going to do it, it's going to be the Astros because of where they're built. But it's really tough to repeat, man.
Well, you know, it'd be interesting to watch the Cubs, too, a year removed from their World Series title, because they got off to a slow start last year. Remember at the All-Star break, the Braves and Cubs had, like, the same record.
They did.
And the Cubs ended up in the playoffs, and the Braves, they did not.
I imagine that.
But, you know, so they got off to a slow start, but they still made it back to the playoffs last year. So maybe, you know, Chicago, they were a little hungover from winning that World Series. It took them a bit to wake up. So, I think you got to throw them certainly in the mix. The Nationals are going to win the East, but I'm with you. I'm not taking them seriously come the postseason.
All right, we'll switch gears one more time here on the crossover. Sam Franco, Chris Brame along with you. The National Football League, and they have changed some rules. First of all, the surviving the ground thing has been eliminated from the, determination on whether it's a catch or not. Although now the debate's just going to go from, well, did he survive the ground, to, well, what's a football move? Because that's what they've determined it as now. The subjective part of it is the football move, which I think is 3 steps or like a lunge. Like if you have the ball in your possession and you lunge, then that's going to be counted. So it'll be different. But the main problem with that was this thing that arose where it looked definitely like they were using this new rule already in the Super Bowl without any sort of approval from the owners or anything. And it just seems bogus. And look, the Patriots don't need any breaks. But both of those instances, the Zach Ertz touchdown where it didn't look like he survived the ground, and the touchdown in the back of the end zone that was bobbled by, you had his name
it was
earlier.
Clement, Corey Clement.
That's right, Corey Clement. just going on what the calls were made throughout the course of the season, neither of those should have been catches based on the rule. So how can you change a rule, not in the middle of the season, but in the most important game?
Because it was the most important. It was the Super Bowl, and the NFL would have looked so many more people would have been exposed to the absurdity of their catch rule, and they knew it was bad, and they knew they were going to change it.
But
they weren't going to have that happen.
Even with or without a change, I still don't think Clements was a catch. Because he doesn't have control of the ball with both feet in bounds.
I think that was a catch, but by the way the rule was, there's no doubt. If that had been the regular season, they would have called it incomplete. But that should be a catch.
No, that's the thing, though. I'm just going based off of like what they had called it throughout the course of the season.
And you're right, which is why Chris Collinsworth and Al Michaels were sitting there watching that, and both of them thought they were going to overturn it.
Uh-huh.
Like it wasn't going to be a catch. And I'm sure they had, you know, millions of people that hadn't watched an NFL game all year that are watching the Super Bowl listen to Al Michaels and Chris Collinsworth
and think,
like, these two sound like morons. They're telling, that's a catch.
Well, I thought they caught unnecessary flack for that because all they were doing was just what everybody else that does watch a lot of games
correct.
Is doing. Like, well, what is it?
Right. Because they were right, 100%. Like, in the regular, what they had seen all year watching football,
yep.
that would have been overturned.
Yep.
But I'm sitting there, there's no way in the Super Bowl they're going to overturn that.
But how can you utilize rules and changes of rules that had not been enacted yet? I mean, that I'd be mad if I was the Patriots or Patriots fans.
Yeah, I know.
But again, I'm not feeling sorry.
Yeah, who's feeling sorry? It's like Duke getting a charge
on what should have
been blocking call, which should have been a charge. But I think what helped with the Ertz thing, though, is when he rolled over, he got grabbed the ball.
He got it back.
That would have been interesting had he rolled over and, like, not been able to re-secure the ball.
Oh, they easily would have called that not a catch, I don't think.
They might have done that then, even though that to me was he caught the ball, went into the end zone, hit the ground,
right.
and lost control. That should
have
been a catch.
But now the rule, the way it is, when he lunged for the end zone, or now that the rule has changed, when he lunged and put the ball over the all the goal line, that's it.
Right.
Touchdown.
Yeah, and that's how it should be.
Yeah. Because
that's how it is for, like, every other player. You just have to, like, stretch the ball over there and touch it. But I guess, too, now in the future, when a ball, if the ball makes contact with the ground and comes loose, then instead of it being incomplete, it's going to be a fumble.
Right, and I thought that, too, because, I mean, they say the ground can't cause a fumble, but that's only if you're, like, touched or, like, tapping into the ground.
It can't if no one's
like,
touched you.
If you're, like, a ball carrier and you trip and hit the ground and then the ball comes out, that's a fumble because
no
nobody forced you
down. Right.
So, now we're going to have that to worry about. I think the more important rule change that they've enacted here is the one that could lead to 15-yard penalties and ejection for players that lower their heads to initiate contact.
Yeah, now that's going to be like the next controversial rule because that is going to have like the subjectivity there that's going to be open
to. Of course, but these players have been, and I know that they're trying to change this in youth football and change the way that people tackle and stuff, but the players that are already in there, that's muscle memory. You know, that's something that is just a reaction. It's really hard to change that because that's what you've done your entire life. And when you're a ball carrier, and I think this will affect ball carriers probably more than tacklers, because they do that. They lower their head to, you know, initiate that contact, lower the boom, so to speak. Whereas, you know, you also have it with receivers, you know, when they make catches and contact is coming, they lower their head to kind of just involuntarily do it to protect themselves.
Yeah. I mean, it changes, it moves the target then.
It
like
does.
You've got them in one spot, you've already started your move to go and tackle, and then if they lower their head, then all of a sudden their head is where it wasn't before and you were targeting to hit them someplace else.
Yeah, that's going to be one to pay attention to for sure because you're talking about players and them having to conscientiously, you know, change their reactions. And that's something that, you know, happens like that. That's not something that, you know, you have a lot of time to make those decisions. So that's why it's almost just an involuntary reaction. So it's going to be very interesting to see how they actually call this and legislate it because you can have ejections for it. I mean, ooh, that's
I know.
Gonna be,
well, I mean, we've dealt with that in college football.
With targeting, right.
Yeah.
And last but not least, this rule didn't get passed, and thank God it didn't, and I'm going to lay into the team that suggested it and withdrew their proposal on it. They were talking about making the NFL's pass interference rule the same as the college's rule, where it's 15-yard penalty for whatever. That's so dumb, because then if somebody burns you, like for a team like the Falcons that has a burner and Julio Jones on the outside, if he burns the corner, they're just going to hook him every single time, because of course you're going to take the 15-yard penalty over the possibility of a long touchdown.
Yeah, but I do wish the NFL would change, but leave leave it in where if it's an obvious blatant one like that, then it's a spot foul. But what I think the NFL is too severe when you got two guys downfield and their legs get tangled up and it's a spot foul.
Right.
That should be 15
yards.
Well,
again, that's more legs tangling. That's not an unintentional deal. So I get that.
Right.
But like that's the thing. When you're asking refs to make subjective calls, you're putting a lot on them. And I just think that the possibility of those big plays being negated and you just easily hooking someone, I think that should outweigh the possibility of maybe like those entanglements, because those don't happen as much.
No, well, I think those should be spot fouls. But
well,
I mean,
clearly start happening if you make it a 15-yard penalty. Like if Julio Jones gets past you, you're going to get hooked because that's what you should do, and that's what they do in college. If anything, I think college needs to adapt more to the NFL's rule, because if it's a clear, blatant hooking someone when they've beaten you, then that should be a spot foul. It shouldn't be just a 15-yard.
No, I agree, but I mean that's if it's clear and blatant. But otherwise, I think the NFL's too severe with the spot foul every single
time.
Well,
maybe now you're asking them to do subjective things again. By the way, the team that proposed that rule change, the Jets. Of course, it was the Jets because they can't throw the ball vertically down the field, so that doesn't impact them. And then they can just use their if their guys get beat, they can hook them and pull them down. So of course, it was the Jets that proposed.
Well, think about the AFC Championship game when right at the end of the half, you know, the Jaguars had dominated that game and Brady threw one down the sideline. And first of all, it was a questionable call to begin with, but he threw one up down the sideline and it was basically the Jags defender. You know, they were both going for the ball and they called pass interference on Jacksonville. And you know, New England got the ball down there at the 5-yard line. I mean, that's too severe of a penalty. It was a bad call. But even if it wasn't, that should just be 15-yard penalty.
Well, I get that there's no guarantee that they would have made the catch. But, again, the blatant ones, though, you're just asking for it if you change the rule to always being a 15-yard penalty. You're just asking to have defensive players just hook guys when they know they're
which
beating.
Is why they should change it to if there is a blatant just you're tackling a guy in the open field when you're clearly beaten, then that's going to be a spot foul. But all the other ones should be 15 yards. I've always thought the NFL's pass interference is too severe.
All right, Brian, that'll wrap things up for us. We'll come back next week. We're going to talk some Georgia baseball next week. We wanted to let that one rest because they have a big series this week and easily their toughest opponent in Texas A&M. So we wanted, because Georgia's looking really good right now, they're ranked in some of the polls, so we want to give them this opportunity to go out there and play against a very tough opponent before we start to make judgments. But right now, all's well on the Georgia baseball front.
Hey, they're tied for first in the SEC.
That's right, with Vandy. So he's Chris Bram, I'm Sam Franco. Thank you so much for listening. We will be back next week with another exciting episode of The Crossover right here on 960theref.com.
You've been listening to The Crossover with Sam Franco and Chris Brain on 960theref.com.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants. They all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.